Welcome to Trinity Life Church Podcast Weekly Sermon. We hope you enjoy listening.
I have been given the task of talking about, cultivation. It should come up on the screen momentarily. So as usual, I'm going to start with a story. So when early teens, I discovered I had a love for skiing. And our school used to do these ski trips away, normally around sort of March, April time, where a load of us from school would all go together. And learning to ski is quite an interesting concept. Have any skiers at all? Anyone who's been skiing? Yeah. No. You've been skiing. So they have this thing. They have this thing when you go skiing called ski school. And ski school is essentially where there's a group of normally about eight or nine of you, and you're paired up with an instructor, and you essentially just follow them in this line. It looks like a kind of mother duck and their ducklings just kind of snaking their way down the piste. So after a kind of couple of goes, I kind of picked it up and realised I really enjoyed it, and. There's different kind of tiers of difficulty of ski slopes. So you start with green, and then you go blue, and then it's red, and then it's black at the top. And so one day on one of the trips, the instructor got to the top and said, "Right, I'm going to do something a little bit different today. For those of you who think that you feel confident enough, we're going to meet down at that point down there. For everyone else, stick with me, because we're going to give this red a go. It's the first time we're giving it a go." And me being the precocious teenage boy that I was like, "Yeah, I'll be fine. I don't need to stick with this guy. I've got this." So off I went, herring down this red slope, which I'd never done before, going at speeds which I probably wasn't used to going. But I was getting quite confident. I was like, "Look at me! I'm going really fast. I'm doing my corners." When you ski to turn, you have to do what's called put your edges into the snow, and that kind of catches and turns you around. But then I hit a snag. There was a patch of ice on the piste, and so I hit that at quite considerable speed, and then went to turn. There is nowhere to put your edges in ice, so I just kept going. And this is the point where I was just going, I have no idea. I've never encountered a patch of ice before. I've never encountered a patch of ice at this speed before. My instructor's up there with everyone else who was sensible enough to stay with him, and I don't know what to do. Now, on the sides of the piste, with these huge mounds of snow, obviously there, intended to stop you going off the edge of the mountain. So all you can see is sort of this mound of snow and then just trees sort of descending down. And I'm herring towards this mound of snow on this ice, going, I can't turn away. And smacked into this mound of snow at full force. Now, whilst it would have been more comical if there was just a kind of Scott-shaped hole in the snow, what actually happened was I hit it with such force that I popped out of my skis, flipped over the mound, and started sliding down the other side. I vividly remember being in the air, sort of flipping over, going, I'm going to die. What a ridiculous way to die. Anyway, so I landed on the other side, started sliding down, and what felt like that at the time transpired. It was actually only about that, but still quite scary at the time. Sort of stopped on a tree, and I was sort of lying there, sort of clinging to the side of this mountain. And all I heard was, I think I was in about year 10 at this point, and there was a mixed group. I think it was one of the year 8s in the school. All I heard was this little voice just come over the mound going, Scott? Yeah? Are you dead? No. So I kind of clambered my way back up, and I was sort of lying on the piste. Sort of one of my skis had disappeared off the other side. One was lying next to me, and then the instructor kind of came up with this sort of smug grin on his face, kind of going, "Do you know Sonny Bono died doing that? Thanks." Anyway, so he went down, retrieved my ski, and off we went down to the bottom of the mountain, and started queuing up again. Now, how does this relate to viral cultivation, I hear you ask? Well, as I usually do, I'll bring that to a close at the end. So what I want to look at this morning is, essentially to start with, no, that's not what I wanted to do, guys, are you? I want to look at what is viral viral cultivation. It's essentially the replication of a virus in a controlled environment. So, something like a petri dish or whatever it might be. But the interesting with viral cultivation is, if you look at if you're trying to culture something like bacteria or a cell, anything like that, you can pretty much grow it wherever you want, as long as you give it what's called a growth medium. So essentially, something for it to eat. You just stick the bacteria on and let it be on its way. Viruses, on the other hand, that doesn't work. They need to be in the right environment. They need to be within the host cell. So essentially, you have to create this bacteria. So say it's a virus that infects a bacteria, or a cell type, you'll grow that. And then you introduce the virus in, because it can only survive and replicate within its the host cell that it's designed for. So how does cultivation relate to the early church? Well, now if we click, I think it parallels really well with discipleship, because essentially what people were doing in the early church was starting with Jesus, the ultimate point, was with his disciples, what he was essentially doing was teaching them to be more like him. So essentially replicating himself in his disciples. And then the early church in Acts, they then followed that same model, that they would teach people to be more like themselves, therefore through that being more like Jesus. So to kind of break down why it's important, I think we'll go back to looking at our viruses. So why on earth would people want to cultivate viruses, particularly the dangerous kinds? Let's see. There we go. So there's three predominant reasons why typically people will cultivate viruses. It will be to identify the virus. It will be to research the effects of the virus. And it will be to prepare, normally, for something like a vaccine. So if we sort of maybe go through some of these qualities, so looking at the identification side of things. So starting with Jesus, obviously the ultimate point of this discipleship, who we're all aspiring to be. So from a characteristics point of view, from an identity point of view, what was he demonstrating to his disciples in the time that he was with them? So firstly, he always had just an honor for worship about him. Jesus always taught about the divinity and the glory of the Father. He wasn't just there to teach the disciples like a kind of, you know, a moral self-help seminar, you know, like a Tony Robbins of the kind of the Roman age. But he was there to bring just pure focus to his heavenly Father and the worship that his Father deserved. And then obviously then as the disciples went through in Acts, given that Jesus himself was God on earth, they were then able to demonstrate the worship of God through Jesus, who was also God. Then Jesus just showed this incredible servanthood. And I think for me, I think the most mind-blowing scriptures for me in the entire, in all of the Gospels, is in John 13. Where it's talking about Jesus washing his disciples' feet. I think we've got that on a slide, if my clicker's not working. I'll click through those. It's just every time I read this, it's just going through my mind of this is God. This is the creator of the entire universe, everything in it, creator of me, in human form, stripping down to a towel and washing the dirt and muck off his disciples' feet. And you've got to think, back in those times, there would have been animal waste and whatever else flying around outside that these disciples may have been walking through. And God is washing this from his disciples' feet. And then in John 13, 12, 17, when he'd finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. And said, "Do you understand what I have done for you?" He asked them. "You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you." I think that's the key message in that point. He set an example for us to follow. "Very truly, I tell you, no servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them. And then the final part was he was a witness for his father. And ultimately then when the early church of Acts came along, again, they were a witness for God through Jesus. So in John 20:21, Jesus obviously makes this statement, "Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, I am sending you." So he was acknowledging the fact that he had been sent by his Father as a witness for him, and then was saying, "And now I need you to go and do the same thing." And then again in Acts, the start of Acts, before he ascends, he tells them, "You will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria," how we've kind of started this whole series looking at how that spread out. So then the next area for us to look at is this whole researching the effects of the virus. So how does this kind of parallel? Well, the way I kind of see it is it's seeing firsthand what it is to live like Christ. For someone who has maybe not been brought up in a Christian household, who's not encountered a Christ-like person before, a lot of these concepts can seem quite alien, quite foreign, scary at times. And so just being sort of, you obviously have your baptism in the Spirit, and the Spirit will kind of give you the gifts to go out there. But I feel that sometimes just trying to kind of go out and do those things without seeing an action can be quite scary for some. So by bringing these people together and sort of discipling each other, they enabled new followers to be able to see what it was like. They could see each other working as that family together, just working, seeing each other, helping each other out. They could see the miraculous healings that were happening, and knowing that then being imparted with the knowledge that they would be given the blessing to be able to go out and do the same. Things like sacrificial giving. There's a great passage in Acts 11, 26, 29, where it's talking about Barnabas and Saul. So it said, when he found him, he brought him to Antioch. So that's talking about Barnabas finding Saul. So for a whole year, Barnabas and Saul met with the church and taught great numbers of people. The disciples were called Christians first at Antioch. During this time, some prophets came down from Jerusalem to Antioch. One of them, named Agabus, stood up and through the Spirit predicted that a severe famine would spread over the entire Roman world. This happened during the reign of Claudius. The disciples, as each one was able, decided to provide help, and in some translations says provide gifts, for the brothers and sisters living in Judea. Now imagine, for a lot of people that were new to, you know, new believers, when their experience of the world probably would have been, someone had said, there's going to be a famine, everyone would have just probably started hoarding and started looking after number one, looking after themselves. But then the instinct of all of the disciples here was, right, what can we do to help others? What can we give to help other people in this famine? So I think that kind of demonstrates sort of the researching the effects of trying to live like Christ, trying to be like Christ. And then the final thing is preparation. So in the cultivation, it's preparing for, say, something like a vaccine. But I think from a discipleship perspective, it's preparing people to go then out into the world and show others the characteristics of Christ. If we got a scripture, I think Acts 18, 24 to 27. So meanwhile, I think this small little passage just quite succinctly, I think, sort of chronicles a journey, that sort of journey from new believer to being discipled to going out. So meanwhile, a Jew named Apollos, a native of Alexandria, came to Ephesus. He was a learned man with a thorough knowledge of the scriptures. He had been instructed in the way of the Lord, and he spoke with great fervor and taught about Jesus accurately, though he only knew only the baptism of John. He began to speak boldly in the synagogue. When Priscilla and Aquila heard him, they invited him to their home and explained to him the way of God more adequately. When Apollos then wanted to go out to Achaia, the brothers and sisters encouraged him, wrote to the disciples there to welcome him. When he arrived, he was a great help to those who by grace had believed. So this person with a limited knowledge coming to be a new follower, he was very excited, as often people are when they've just got saved and they're running around sort of sharing the good news. But he only had a sort of an understanding up until a certain point. So two of the sort of more senior or more sort of learned sort of people within the disciples, took him under their wing, filled in the gaps, taught him what he needed to know, and then encouraged him to then, once he was prepared, to then go out and share the news with others. It's quite an appropriate one for me personally. When I don't know if I've told this story before, but when I originally got saved, I was one of those ones. So I got saved preparing for a missionary trip, and then got baptized while we were actually out there doing the mission. So I fell in love with this the idea of being a missionary from Christ. And so I came back and I was on fire and I was telling everyone about my faith and I was like, I feel I am being called to be a missionary. I am going to be a missionary. And so I went full into it. Went on a missionary training course for a week. Signed up to become on a missionary apprenticeship. And was actually sort of provisionally accepted to go on a missionary apprenticeship in Nepal. And so this was about 6 months after I got saved. And then I took a day, it was about 2 weeks before I had to kind of sign on the dotted line to kind of go away. And I took a day of sort of prayer and fasting. Again, I think it was the first probably time I'd actually done that in my new walk. And just spent the entire day praying over this. Like, God, is this the right thing for me? Is this definitely what you want me to do? And I remember that was the first time I sort of tangibly heard the voice of God. And all it said was, you're not ready yet. It's like, you don't know enough about me, yourself. How will you go out and tell others about me? And I was like, oh, yeah, that's a good point. Because I wasn't prepared enough at that point. I didn't know enough of things like the gift of the Spirit. At that point, I don't think I'd actually been baptized in the Holy Spirit at that point. So, thankfully, obviously, God swooped in before I did any damage. And then it's taken a few years. And I still feel I have that heart for being a missionary one day. But it's going to be in the future. It's going to be when I'm more prepared and when God tells me the timing's right. So that's the why. So then we need to now look at the how, which I think is the next one, yeah. So, looking at our viruses, the only way those viruses would cultivate is in the right environment. So, what is the right environment for discipleship? If we look at typically how Jesus sort of worked with his disciples, it was in small groups, in small gatherings. He'd bring them together. He'd share the message to his disciples in terms of how to live like him. He obviously was out and preaching the word to Jerusalem and all the Jewish people. But if you notice, a lot of those kind of one-on-one lessons, the parables, were he brought his disciples together into a small group and shared with them how to be more like him. So for me, to disciple people, the right environment is two things. It's here on a Sunday where we gather together as a family. And it's things like our connect groups, our home groups, all of the different brandings that we have with them now. But they're, you know, these are the best place that when we're getting new sort of new followers, but also experienced, and we always need to learn. It's going to be best in those areas. Viruses, when they replicate, they pass on instructions to the next generation through the genetic material, so either the DNA or the RNA, of how to replicate themselves. It's something that happens in the entirety of the animal kingdom. When you reproduce, you pass on the genetic knowledge of how to do the same thing. And so in sort of from a discipleship perspective, I think this is quite key that we're not just discipling people to be like Christ in terms of how they're acting and what they're doing, but also in terms of being like Christ in how to then pass on that knowledge to others to be like Christ. So as part of my role in I sort of do a kind of player manager role within sales. So I look after some of the selling side of things, but the largest part of my role is actually coaching and mentoring the more junior sales guys in my team. And there's a very simple methodology that I was taught in terms of coaching, which is I do, we do, you do. So it's essentially, I'll do something, so I'll show them a particular sales technique or something, sales methodology. I'll do it, I'll show them in action, maybe they'll listen to one of my calls. Then I'll do it with them together. So maybe do like a role play where they can pretend to be the client, I'll be the salesperson, and then we'll flip it round, let them have a go, and I can give them feedback on what they need to do differently. And then at that point, then it's you do. Right, now you need to go and you need to try your hand at this, and I can listen into your call and I can give you feedback when you're speaking live. It's the same, I think, with discipling people. We can't just tell people this is what you need to do. We need to demonstrate it. We need to work it out with them. And then at the point, we can then help people then go out and do the same. And then finally, for the how, I think it's, this is where I can kind of articulate it, is strength in numbers. Because the more viruses you introduce to this little petri dish full of bacteria, the quicker that the cultivation is going to be. I think it's inherently impossible to disciple alone. You can be a disciple of, say, you can say you're being a disciple of Jesus because you're trying to be like him. But one of the things that was inherent in what Jesus did was to disciple others. So if you're not discipling others, then you're kind of falling short of what Jesus was intending for us to be a disciple. There's also an element of support within that. As I said earlier, for some, the prospect of a new follower, living that kind of idea of being like Christ is such a daunting idea. It could be old hang-ups and insecurities that they have. It could be old sin that they're still struggling to deal with. So there's two things that kind of comes with that support. You have someone to hold you to account. This accountability thing is something that's big with me and Matt at the moment. So for those of you who remember last year, I think one of my first preaches, I based it around going to the gym and fitness and things like that. But at the time, I'm a little bit, but it was quite chunky. And that was because I wasn't consistent enough with going to the gym. So what me and Matt have done is we've come up with a method where we can be accountable to each other. So it makes sure, and so since we've started that, is it for like the last, 2 months? We haven't missed a day? So just having someone to be accountable for is a huge deal. But it's also there for that, so if someone does stumble, if someone does fall, we can show them that there is a reason to get back up. And this is where it brings me back to my skiing story at the start. So, as I said, I'd taken this fall, gone down to the bottom, and I started queuing up for the ski lift again. And the instructor looked at me and he went, "What are you doing?" I was like, "Going back up the mountain." He was like, "Why?" He was like, "If that's been any of my other students, they'd be straight back at the lodge, feet up, shivering with a hot chocolate." And so I explained to him, I was like, "Well, look, my mum's a single mum, and she has had to work extra hours. She's had to put a lot of effort in. She's made a significant sacrifice so I can be on this trip. So I don't want my mum's sacrifice and all that time and effort she's put in to be for nothing. So I'm going to make the most out of this. So I'm just going to go back up. I'm going to try again." But I learned from it. So I stayed close to the instructor. I made sure I didn't kind of run off on my own this time. I made sure that I looked at the identity of who this instructor was. What was he doing? How was he acting? I was researching. I was looking. I was testing out ideas with him. And ultimately, he was preparing me for actually being able to actually go out and ski on my own. So if I did hit things like a patch of ice, I knew what I was doing with. And so the following year when I went back, I actually got to the point where, I think, have we got a picture? No, there it is. I was awarded something called the 4-star British Alpine Ski Award, which basically meant if I wanted to, I could then actually then take the course to train to be an instructor myself. Now, all of that overcoming that challenge, that fall, succeeding to become an instructor myself, never would have come if my mum hadn't made the sacrifice for me to be there. And I wouldn't have gone back up if I hadn't looked at it and thought, I need to honour that sacrifice. I can't let that sacrifice go to waste. So this brings us to today and what we're celebrating. Because I think that we've talked about all of these different qualities that we're trying to emulate, we're trying to be like in Christ. And thing is, I think so many people, and a lot, even a lot of people within the church, define Christ by his sacrifice. It's almost for them where the kind of story ends. You know, you see a lot of people where, you know, you've got imagery of Christ still hanging on the cross. But the thing is, what we're celebrating today is not his death, but his resurrection, his victory over death. So if we're cultivating people that are going to be like Christ, what we're doing is we're cultivating victors. So I want to show you a quick video before you click play. It's has anyone seen the film The 300, or familiar with what the film's about? So it's based on apparently history, but I think it's more myth legend, of a group of 300 Spartans that defended a pass from the invading Persian army. They were massively outnumbered, but they still went to defend what they could. Ultimately, they were defeated through betrayal, but the sacrifice of those 300 had quite an astonishing impact, which that you see at the end of the film.
Barely a year ago, long I pondered my king's cryptic talk of victory. Time has proven him wise. But from free Greek to free Greek, the word was spread that bold Leonidas and his 300, so far from home, laid down their lives, not just for Sparta, but for all Greece and the promise this country holds. Now, here on this rugged patch of earth called Plataea, Xerxes' hordes face obliteration! Just there, the barbarians huddle. Sheer terror gripping tight. Their hearts, with icy fingers, knowing full well what merciless horrors they suffered at the swords and spears of 300. Yet they stare now, across the plain, at 10,000 Spartans, commanding 30,000 free Greeks. Ho! The enemy outnumbers a paltry 3-1. Good odds for any Greek. This day, we rescue a world from mysticism and tyranny, and usher in a future brighter than anything we can imagine. Defenseman! To Leonidas and the brave 300! The victory!
And they win. So, the sacrifice of a few inspired the victory for a many. And that's what I think as a church we need to be focusing on, especially today when we're talking about cultivation, when we're talking about discipleship. We want to be cultivating victors, people that are going to go out and they're going to be victorious in their workplace, in their schools, in politics, in sport, just over everything in their lives, over mental health, over financial issues. They are going to be victorious in any challenge that they face. That is the discipleship. That's what we want to be cultivating in this church, because that is the stuff that the world is going to take note of. People are going to see the victors, and they're going to wonder what it is. What is it, this quality that makes this person victorious in their life? And that's where we can start sharing the message of Christ and his sacrifice and his ultimate victory over death. So I want to take some time now. If there's people here that want victory in their lives, just in their lives altogether or over a certain aspect, whatever it might be, I'd like you to just come forward, and we want to pray for you. We want to pray for that victory over your life. If you don't feel comfortable, come into the front, just raise your hand, and someone around you can pray for you. That's the whole point of what we were saying about us being together. So, if anyone does want to come to the front, we'll pray for you now. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Scott. It's a really, really important message that Scott has just brought there. And I think one of the keys there is also the fact that Scott mentioned around what Jesus has already done. And, you know, are we prepared, like Scott was, to get back up and get to the top of that mountain and say, you know what, I'm not allowing Jesus' sacrifice to be a nothing in my life. Jesus has already won the victory. We're in a place of victory. Now, we can pretend that we're not and live in some kind of weird failure. Or we can get up and say, you know what, regardless of how I feel, I know that Christ has won the victory, and I'm going to get up and I'm going to get back to the top of that mountain, and I'm going to see this thing won. Now, you may not feel like it right now. You may be still waiting for the manifestation of that victory, but you know what? That victory is done. Jesus has won it. We just need to engage with it. We need to, as Scott was saying, in discipleship, we need to see what Jesus was doing and follow in that. We follow in his victory. We are victorious. We just need to claim that. So please, if there is something that you just want to have the leadership team or anyone else really, just to stand with you and just pray that victory, pray in that stance of victory. I want to be victorious. I am victorious. I want to see that victory through. And please come down the front. It could be anything. It could be a job. It could be a situation in your life. Anything at all. And that's kids as well. If there's anything, kids, you want to stand for, I want to see victory in this, then please come down the front and someone will pray for you. Amen.